This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. American Public Television has drawn audiences with hit programs from British television like All Creatures Great and Small. That BBC series tells the story of James Herriot, who practiced as a veterinary surgeon in the English countryside for almost 50 years. Mitzi Brunsdale taught English at Mayville State University for more than 50 years before she retired several years ago. Besides teaching, she has gained distinction as a critic and writer. And years ago, she wrote the first full-length literary study of Herriot, and recently, she sat down with Prairie Pulse host John Harris to talk about Harriet's lasting appeal.
Dr. Brunsdale, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
As we start off, you're here to talk about a book you wrote on James Herriot. But before we get into the book, tell the folks a little bit about yourself and your background.
I am actually a comparative lit person. I've done a lot of writing, 9 books to date. And most recently, I write on Norwegian murder mysteries.
Norwegian murder mysteries.
Well, yes.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, with that said, tell us more about your writing and your teaching career.
I love to teach. I've taught most of my time near Mayville, North Dakota, where my husband farmed. And that's why I was so interested in Herriot, because the place and the people he worked among were very much like what we were working with at North Dakota.
Yeah, well, the book you wrote here, of course, PBS viewers may recognize the name. He was a British veterinarian, but author of course, All Creatures Great and Small. So why did you develop an interest in writing about him?
I had read his books and loved them when I was younger. And I had just finished a book on James Joyce, the Irish author, who was very complicated, very scholarly work, very hard work. I was tired. And the editor of Twain's English Authors series called me about 2 days after I finished the Joyce book and said, would you like to write on James Herriot? And I said, I would get down on my knees to write on James Herriot.
Yeah, but again, where did that big interest come from?
I love animals. I've had animals all my life, and I've never met a vet I didn't like.
Okay. You mentioned Twain English Author. I guess they have Twain's English Author series.
Yes.
Tell us more about that.
Yes. The idea was to produce books that the average, ordinary author would write for the ordinary public, not for scholars, not for people who were specialists in the field, to bring that author's work to a bigger public.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, do you know how many authors they work with or how
Oh, goodness.
How many books?
I think there were over 30 in the series.
Okay, well, let's go back a little bit to James Herriot, I guess, because I understand because of his declining health at the time of your writing of the book. Can you talk about the difficulty in contacting him and trying to meet him?
He was camera shy. He didn't like to give interviews. He had been on author's tours in this country twice, and that was enough for him. People were swarming the Yorkshire Dales to meet him. He said his right hand gave out from autographs. And so toward the end of his life, though no one knew it at the time, he was suffering from prostate cancer. He and his son were trying to get some black-faced sheep out of their garden. And in the process, one of the sheep knocked him against a stone wall. Poor man broke his leg in several places. And the next winter, he passed away. So his health was very, very fragile. And we were not able to meet with him in person.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we've talked a little bit off camera, but can you talk a little bit about your interactions with his wife?
We didn't see much of her or hear much about her. She was apparently a very practical lady. And when he started writing in the late 1960s, she told him several times that old vets of 50 years old didn't write books. And he said that inspired him, and he went out and bought paper and a typewriter, and he started in his writing. And it proved to be very, very popular.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about your book for a moment. How did you organize the book into various chapters?
I organized it around the books that he wrote. He wrote 5 books based on stories that he had experienced himself and that his friends had experienced as veterinarians in the Yorkshire Dales. He wrote about 1 year of his life per book. And these were set in the late 1930s. So he was, as an older man, he was writing about his younger self and his work then. And he did spend 2 years in the RAF during World War II. And when he came back to his veterinary work, he realized that all of a sudden the world had changed with antibiotics and new operations and all kinds of things. So his practice had changed from basic draft horses to small animal practice.
Hmm. Yeah. With that said, can you read us a passage from your book and give
certainly.
Us a little taste or flavor?
Certainly. This is about his comments about the man who was the actor playing him in the first BBC movie written that they worked on. And he said, and as a very modest man, he said, "I have always been puzzled by the fact that Simon Ward, who was playing me, told me later that he was absolutely petrified at the prospect of meeting me. For a man who had just made a great name for himself playing Winston Churchill, it seemed odd. An obscure country vet was certainly insignificant by contrast."
Hmm. Well, and you mentioned getting to do research, I guess, on this book, you met or talked with the actor.
Yes, yes. We had hoped to meet Dr. Harriet, but his health prevented it. So we were traveling in Yorkshire in 1975, and we stayed at a little town called Askrigg, which is in the Yorkshire Dales, very near where he practiced. And it just happened that day they were filming a passage, and we could talk to any of the actors or any of the workers, but we could not get near their cars. The vintage automobiles that they had for the series were brought there in big trucks, and they had them out, but you couldn't get near them. That was very, very sacred.
What did you learn, though, from the actor over that time?
How very impressed he was with how humble a man he was playing. Christopher Timothy, the actor, had been a classical actor from Wales originally. He played Harriet for 13 years and became typecast, so he never did much work after that. But he was very, very taken with the role. He learned a lot, he said, about the veterinary practice in having to actually show it on the film.
Yeah. Well, so as you mentioned a little bit about modest, but what kind of person was James Harriet?
Quiet, unassuming. He wanted to be known as 99% veterinarian and 1% writer. And in that 1% writer, he wrote 18 books, 9 for children and the others for adults. I think it's best exemplified maybe by the anecdote he has in one of his books. He was traveling around the Dales with a friend, and they stopped at a farm where there were some sick animals, and Harriet was going to treat them. And he introduced the friend to the farmer, saying that this man had come to see him as a veterinary surgeon. And the farmer said, "Well, he's not a bad vet either." And that meant more to him, I think, than the writing.
Hmm. Yeah. Did you get a sense of what his view of the world was in his life?
Definitely. Many times in the literature that appeared about him, he was quoted as saying that his books were all about hard work and integrity. And I think that's what makes him so fascinating for us now.
Hmm. You know, again, so why did he decide to write a book after all those years as a vet? I mean, you mentioned his wife inspired him with her comments.
But. Yes. He would come home and tell her funny stories about things that had happened to him. And that's when he started thinking maybe he should write all those things down. And later on, he said all of it had actually happened. Most of it to him, but some of it to some of his friends. But it was all true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So did you get a sense of what he thought of the PBS series that, of course, followed that probably made him more internationally famous?
He liked it very, very much. He would watch it religiously himself. In England, I believe the first series was put on Sundays, and there were actually church services that changed their time so people could get home and watch it.
I'm sure there were. After you published your book, did you have a chance to hear from his wife or understand what her reaction was to the book?
No. As I say, they wanted to be very private people. His son has written a book much later, and it's excellent. It draws on letters and things that nobody could have had any access to except his family.
Okay. Well, we're going to ask you to read another couple of passages. Maybe you have one picked out now.
All right, I do. In the early history of veterinary medicine by Sir Frederick Smith, he describes what a good vet should be. A gentle, amiable man of great benevolence and humanity, a prodigious worker, ever faithful to the cause he undertook to serve, a pioneer of the veterinary art, whose name is written in letters of gold upon the tablets of his profession. Harriet felt that there was a great relationship between animals and humans, and he actually suggested that there was an element of healing with a sick person and an animal. And I think when we work with therapy animals, and I have one, I take her to Alzheimer's patients, and you can see that there is definitely an interaction between them. Harriet was one of the first people to point that out. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a very valuable lesson for us.
Okay. Well, you made the comment a while ago that he was 99% vet and 1% writer. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he wrote a number of books. And so, you know, what does that really mean? What did you really mean by
that? He had hoped at the beginning, because veterinary work was very ill-paid in England, and he had hoped to make a little bit more money that way. And oddly enough, his books took off much better in the United States than they had in England. And he thought that that was because Americans were better animal lovers than the British, and because we have a better sense of humor. And he saw his humorous stories, and many of them are humorous, that there is an incongruity between human actions and the more reasonable actions of animals.
I like the way you put more reasonable reactions. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. What is the first question you would have asked Mr. Harriet if you'd been able to meet him?
He was offered many times positions in countries like Ireland where he wouldn't have to pay so much income tax, and he always turned it down because he wanted to stay with his practice. And I would have asked him what sacrifices he had to make in order to do that. He was at the height of his popularity. He was paying about 83% of his income to the Inland Revenue in Britain.
Hmm. Wow. Okay. So what kind of advice would you have for young people that maybe they've never written, or maybe they think they might like to write?
A big wastebasket. Keep at it. Sometimes it's very difficult to get it right, but when you get it right, and I believe it was Dorothy L. Sayers, a murder mystery writer, who said this, when you finally get it right, you feel like God on the seventh day.
Well, of course, you and I come from maybe an older school, because nowadays with computers, I know a gentleman that I knew that used to use a typewriter to write everything in a day. He said when computers came out, he could just put out so much more material. Did you find that during your times?
Certainly, it's much easier to access reference material, much easier, much easier to take notes and so forth. It's a different process. If you are writing by hand or a typewriter, you have to think harder before you put it down, because you know you're going to have to go back and fix it. With the computer, fixing it is so easy, And worse yet, it looks so good when you print it out. And you think, oh, I'm done. And you don't revise the way you should.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. So revisions, you know, because again, this is getting into writing. Mm-hmm. So again, what is the best advice you would give a writer mm-hmm. just starting out? You said a wastebasket, but
yes.
But really,
mm-hmm.
is it write about what you love? What about it?
You have to know what you're writing about. And I do think that with Harriet, with the Harriet book, I lived 30 years on a working farm near Mayville, North Dakota, where the people are largely descended from Scandinavians, mostly Norwegians. And that was the kind of people Harriet was working amongst, because Yorkshire has a very high population that has been descended from the Vikings. And a lot of the place names and people's names are definitely Scandinavian-related in Yorkshire. And the whole business of working on a farm, I think raising children on a farm, having animals on a farm, I think that's a very healthy thing. And it made me capable, I think, of working with Harriet, for one thing. I don't like to think about reading Scandinavian murder mysteries and thinking of personal experience. But certainly the patterns of people's thought are similar.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Well, thanks for that. If people mm-hmm. are interested in finding out more or getting mm-hmm. a copy of your book, where can they go? Who can they contact?
It's out of print. I think there are electronic copies available, but it's an old book now. It was came out in the 90s, late 90s, so it's very hard to get the real thing. But I think the electronic versions are available.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Prairie Pulse host John Harris in a discussion with author Mitzi Brunsdale. You can watch the entire show on our television service Friday evening at 7:30 Central. Next, a North Dakota folk story.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starian Bank, determined to provide smart banking solutions with innovative checking accounts and personal banking tools that match your lifestyle. Starian, taking you farther. Learn more at StarianBank.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Telltale, Folk Life and Stories is a project of the North Dakota Council on the Arts. It's described as a collection of narratives about the shared personal experiences and love of life on the North Dakota Plains. Today, we'll share a story titled Divination for Graves.
Some call it witching, some call it dowsing or divining. It's been used for hundreds of years to find water, artifacts, treasure. It's thought to have originated in Germany in the 16th century, but contemporary dowsers like Roger Harmon often use simple L-shaped metal rods. Holding one in each hand, the rods cross over one another when something is located.
They call it witching, I guess, huh?
I've done that ever since I was about 18 years old. My grandfather, he had a willow twig. And he could even tell you how deep it was to that water vein. He taught me how to do that witching for a grave. I use anything, welding rods or a wrecking bar or crowbar or anything to find an unmarked grave. And the wires will cross when I come over the grave, and then when I'm done with it, they open again after I walked over the grave or whatever.
What makes Roger's talent for witching so unique is that not only is he able to locate lost or misplaced gravesites, using a carpenter's plumb bob, he can even determine the sex of the deceased. Roger's good friend Charlie has witnessed this many times.
With a carpenter's plumb bob, I can sex a grave to tell whether it's a male or a female. It can even be cremated. It's just a regular carpenter's plumb bob on about, 40 inches of string.
And then he'll watch and he says, now if it goes in a circle, he says it's a female. And he says if it's a male, it's going to go this way, and in a female, it'll go around. And the male would be a straight line. Not everybody can do it, though.
Roger and Charlie are often called on to help locate graves. Circumstances led them to help locate a number of unidentified infant graves at St. Gertrude Cemetery in Raleigh, North Dakota.
That's where these babies were buried along the fence. St. Gertrude's there where we witched and stuff.
In those days, there was no church. There was no priest. The priest closest was Father Bernd Strassmeyer out of Fort Yates. You know, he'd come with the saddle horse, you know, and hold mass in these little homesteads. And when Roger come down to witch it, you know, I told him the same thing. You know, these babies were born probably premature, stillborn, whatever it was. And that's why they wound up all in this one little corner, because they weren't baptized when they died. So they put them all in, kind of in a group there. They weren't baptized. I suppose the church had something to say if they weren't baptized, you know. Oh, God, there's, like he says, there are so many families that lost children, you know. There's so many stillborns.
By today's standards, it's hard to imagine losing track of a child's gravesite. But times were different then.
This is before railroad. This is before Black Hills Trail. They'd have to go through Raleigh, Dogtooth, up to Flasher. And he says, we got up to Fallon. We're on a team of horses with a wagon. And he says, we got in to this farmstead, and they couldn't understand why there was so many teams of horses and people around. Now, this is, could be probably March or April, and people are crying. And my great-grandfather asked him in German, you know, was geht da on? Meaning, what's going on here? Well, we're all here to pick up our deceased. This was a midwife, and they put them all into the snowbanks. As she delivered them, if they died, they stick them into the snowbanks to preserve them until, you know, the ground was frozen during the time, maybe a bad winter, all snow, whatever. And they take their deceased home. It sounds a little cruel, but that's exactly what happened.
Parents came to Roger and Charlie in hopes that they could find their child's grave and properly mark it.
I had people come up to me and ask me, she says, you know, our first child was a stillborn. I buried the baby here at St. Gertrude. She says, we buried her here. We didn't have no money. Is there a way that you could find out where my daughter is buried? She says, all I know, it was a wooden cross that we put up, but then with the snow and stuff and dry rot of the wood, I thought I'd never forget where I buried it.
Back then, child mortality rates were very high, and many mothers died in childbirth. Stillborn babies were often buried with their deceased mothers.
Right here in New Salem, a mother died having her baby, and it was a male. And there was a woman here in town that was to the funeral. She swears up and down that the baby was on mom's right shoulder when they buried it. It took me a while, but I found the baby on her right shoulder.
Families were often very large, and the loss of a mother called for the community to come to their aid.
It's sad, but I think one year there was like three women that lost their lives given childbirth. I think there was something like 33 young kids in those three families. And then, of course, Roger took four, you took three. You know, they spread them around in the community, you know. And that's how those kids were raised.
You can hear more of the Telltale Stories online at arts.nd.gov. Coming up on Main Street, a Plainsfolk essay from Tom Ezern and Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota Insurance Commissioner John Gottfried says the state's insurance market is strong and competitive, especially across those lines his office directly regulates. Gottfried says most of the issues come from flood insurance and health insurance.
Both of those lines of insurance have a really strong federal presence regulatorily.
Gottfried says he is supporting efforts to bring some of that regulatory authority back to the state.
By being able to do that, we're able to adapt to some of the uniqueness that's, you know, inherently in North Dakota and other states. And we've seen it really tough to find that kind of one-size-fits-all method that fits either in, whether that's, you know, health insurance or flood insurance. I think our legislature probably knows our citizens better than the congressional folks out in D.C.
Gottfried says there have been attempts to further erode state insurance regulation, but he says the McCarran-Ferguson Act, passed in Congress in the 1960s, gives states-based state-based insurance regulation its foundation. UND has no plans to cut its budget in the spring of 2021. That's according to Jed Shivers, UND's vice president for finance and operations and the school's COVID-19 point person. But Shivers says things could certainly change.
If I would say that we are forced to close during that period and we get into issues of lost revenue as a result of the pandemic, then such things are possible. We would really have to look and see what sort of federal avenues are available for relief before we made decisions like that.
Shivers said some big questions going into the summer of 2021 are, what does enrollment look like and what is the state's plan regarding the operating budget? Shivers made his comments during a virtual town hall with faculty and staff. And as the nation waits for the presidential race to be settled, North Dakota Senator Kevin Cramer says President Trump made a tactical error leading up to the election.
I think the president made a mistake in not embracing voting by mail and rather than pushing against it, encouraging Republicans to do it. And that's part of what's, you know, sort of tilted things their way, the Democrats' way, is that they're the ones now that get to bring in votes 2, 3, 4, 5 days, 9 days, up to 9 days later.
In Cramer's words, quote, when the rules change, you have to play by the new rules, whether you like them or not. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we have an in-depth conversation with President Jefferson. He talks about a number of things, including his own inauguration.
His first inaugural address is one of the very best in American history, and Mr. Jefferson quotes from it and says, "Every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. We are all Federalists. We are all Republicans." He wanted to bind the country back together after one of the most hotly contested elections in our history.
A hotly contested election and also a lengthy one.
It took 36 ballots in the House of Representatives before the election was finally credited to Mr. Jefferson.
He talked about how much he believed in the spirit of the American people.
Jefferson believed that the people are up to it, that we are capable of indefinite perfectibility, and that when we are really in a crisis, our commitment to small R republicanism always reasserts itself.
Please join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a history professor and a storyteller. His Plainsfolk essays are rooted in his research about the history of the Great Plains. And today's piece is titled Proper Amusements.
There was some talk about it in 1885, but it was November 1886 before folks in Williamsport, Emmons County, organized a meeting to consider forming a literary society. Literary societies, often just referred to as the literary, as in, I picked up my sweetheart and took her to the literary last night, were common across the country, but tough to get going in the hardscrabble earliest days of prairie settlement. Before long, though, every community came to the point when people decided we should have a literary. The first effort in Linton County in 1886 failed. Attendance was sparse. The local editor thought it best to defer, remarking, "A cooperation of all the literary talent in the community is necessary to keep alive and interesting a literary society." A literary, which was what exactly? A literary was an organized meeting of adult citizens, commonly in the schoolhouse, to enjoy the company of neighbors and to seek the things which are above. Literature, debate, drama, music, all in do-it-yourself fashion. School teachers played important roles as coordinators and hosts, but the drivers were citizens who hungered for culture. Over in Elbridge, Stutzman County, in March 1891, it was evident that the literary impulse had emerged, for the press reported a meeting of an established literary society with the usual varied musical and declamatory attachments, it said. This is the first record of a functioning schoolhouse literary I have uncovered so far in North Dakota. There was to be a debate on women's suffrage, but the pro-suffrage advocates did not show up. So parties in attendance agreed to debate, impromptu, the question of country life versus city life, country life being designated the affirmative. The affirmative prevailed, to general satisfaction of those in attendance, who agreed the next month to take on the third party question, the matter of the People's Party, that was challenging the two old parties in the cause of farmers' rights. Literary sprang up during the 1890s, as evidenced by a multi-district effort organized at Greenview in Steele County, 1894, boasting officers, constitution, bylaws, and a seven-piece band. The band is a hint that literary meetings sometimes devolved into dances that lasted to near dawn. The Greenview literati took up a collection of $3 to buy a hanging lamp, a necessity for literary readings, a common purchase by emerging societies. A fine example of literary activity was the report of a meeting at Cooperstown in March 1898, a glorious success from every point of view, the editor of the Griggs Courier declared. People drove in from as far as 15 miles for a literary program that lasted from 8:30 to 11 o'clock, with dialogues, tableaux, music, pantomimes, recitations, and speeches, followed by a palatable lunch, and then some attendees refused to depart until time for milking the next morning. Literaries evolved into general community organizations, handling things like holiday celebrations. The Cooperstown Courier, for instance, reported the literary had a Christmas tree in the schoolhouse on Christmas night, with a packed house of 150. Not yet having enough of neighborliness, literary citizens turned out on New Year's Eve for a literary society and watch meeting to watch the passing of 1904 and the birth of 1905. Country folk witnessed a literary crescendo that first decade of the new century, as over at Fluto Bridge, the first regular Friday night literary of January 1905 was a corker. A lawyer named A.M. Baldwin agreed to debate two preachers, Reverends Batchelor and Harris, on the question whether dancing and card playing are proper amusements for young people. The decision is not disclosed. I'd like to know, wouldn't you?
That's Tom Easern. Next on our show, Sue Balcom talks about foods that taste better in November.
And her favorite expression was, go fry ice. When she died, I suggested that we put it on her gravestone, but my siblings outvoted me on that.
Have you heard other variants like go fry an egg or go fry your face?
No!
My friends and I would simply say corn.
This week on Away With Words.
These are the people that can help me.
That's Away With Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and because it's time to talk about food, Sue Balcom.
Sue joins us once a week from her farm outside of Mandan, the Root Cellars Farm, to talk about food. Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Food is my favorite topic to talk about.
So what are you eating right now?
Isn't that something? It's getting so cold out, and I've had this craving for salad that doesn't make any sense because your body kind of does seasonal eating. So this time of year, when it gets kind of cold, you should always be thinking about things that you can eat that will give your body enough energy to stay warm. Like, I've been so cold already this year, and it's just the beginning. But there are vegetables that actually get better after it turns cold. Mm. Hence, the carrots are still in my high tunnel. The beets are still in my high tunnel. And of course, the apples and potatoes and things like that are down in the root cellar, kind of like keeping cool at less than 40 degrees, but above freezing, which would be about 32 degrees. But you know, when you leave certain vegetables in your garden in the fall and they get frost or they get exposed to cold, they actually become sweeter. There's some reason why their starches turn sugar before it hits your stomach, because you, you know all that goes. Like,
well, I think that works for sugar beets, too.
Oh, maybe, because they're probably still in the ground or close to getting ready to harvest those babies, right? And you got to do it before the ground in North Dakota freezes. And there's always just kind of like this small window of opportunity. Mm-hmm. I left my carrots in the ground once a little bit long, and my husband told me he's never going to break them out of that frozen ground for me again. So I have to make sure and get them in the house in an appropriate time.
Well, this segment of the show is called Main Street Eats. So give us some ideas about how we can use these foods that taste best in November to good advantage.
So parsnips, we all familiar with parsnips. Man, I love parsnips. And that was something that I don't think we had when we were kids. But they really, really get good in November. And you can find them in the grocery store. And a lot of these root vegetables are really good roasted. So parsnips kind of have a carrot. You can get them. They're shaped kind of like a white carrot.
Yeah.
But they have more of a radish tinge to them. So they're a little bit like a little more sharp when you eat them. Put some some butter and salt and pepper on. I was going to say sugar, but no, reserve that for your squash. And Brussels sprouts. You know, everybody makes faces about Brussels sprouts, but oh my gosh.
Oh, I
Brussels,
love them.
Oh, so do I. They're kind of like little mini cabbages. And so once they've been frosted, they get a little bit sweeter. Their bitterness goes away. And there's nothing as good as squashed Brussels sprouts with cheese on them. And you put that in the oven till that cheese gets a little bit crunchy on the top. Yum, yum.
Well, in restaurants, a very popular side dish these days is roasted Brussels sprouts.
Oh, yes. And if you've never had them, you can actually grow them here. They grow on a long stalk, and then they have their little tiny Brussels, for lack of a better term, that grows on either side and up the stalk. And they are delicious and they're fun. You know, like you can make a game out of Brussels sprouts with your kids, I'm sure, because of the shape, you know, to get them to try it. And like I said, cheese never hurts. So, and of course, cabbage, you know, there's more to cabbage than sauerkraut. You know, sauteed cabbage or cabbage rolls are delicious. And cabbage is easy to find in November. And they are, you know, you can use them for coleslaw, but if you want them warm, you can make warm coleslaw like you can make warm potato salad. Sauteing that in a pan, adding a little oil and onion, and then throwing some vinegar over the top of it. And of course, everybody knows that pigs in the blankets are not hot dogs rolled up in crescent rolls, right? Pigs in the blankets are cabbage with a meat filling. There's rice, there's tomatoes. My mother also made something in the fall called halupsi. And that was basically the same ingredients in cabbage rolls, pigs in the blanket, but it was chopped up and served kind of as a hot dish. So that you didn't have to like peel that cabbage off and toss it like I know some people do. But cabbage is good for you. Yeah. I spent all that time rolling those pigs up. Why are you taking them apart and not eating the cabbage is the question of the day. But cabbage is also good cooked with potatoes like my mom made. And there's a German word for it that has the word stump in it. And I can't think of what the other one is. But you boil your potatoes and you boil your cabbage and you put allspice and bay leaf in there, salt and pepper. And then you remove your spices and mash that cabbage into your potatoes. Oh, man, that is so good. Sometimes she would brown flour like you were making a roux, but you brown the flour so it's toasty and nutty, and you mix that in there too when you're mashing your potatoes. It's kind of a unique spicy side dish. And, you know, in the wintertime, we need spice to keep us warm also.
Well, let's talk about the vegetable that kids love, which is carrots.
Oh, carrots? Do they? I'm sure they do. But they should get the kind of carrots that actually look like carrots instead of those little tiny ones that have been through a tumbler to make them rounded on the edge. Yes, I'm like, those are not baby carrots. Sorry, I had to say that out loud because it just puzzles me when carrots are an easy vegetable to peel. You don't even have to peel the ones that you get from farmers markets. They're usually so clean. All you need to do is brush them off. And they don't have a hard skin on, but oh my gosh, get some tiny thin carrots and roast those and put a little maple syrup and butter on them. Oh, your kids will love that. But if they don't, you know, sometimes they can't chew things as easily as we can as adults. So there's this cowboy potato, mashed potato recipe where you take and throw carrots in with your potatoes and mash them up with butter and a little cream. And your potatoes get a pretty color yellow and you get that additional nutritional kick from the carrots that are boiled in there also. And they're good raw, but in the winter when it's cold, you know, but soup, you know, you can brown hamburger with a little bit of onion, throw some chicken stock in there, some potatoes, tomatoes, carrots, or maybe a little jar of leftover salsa if you have any salsa in there to make kind of like a spicy vegetable soup that is delightful when you're in a hurry. That's a good soup to serve for supper. Which brings me to leeks, so that you can have leek and potato soup also in the wintertime, which is delightful. I love leeks. I tried growing them. I wasn't very successful.
I haven't gotten my leeks to be very good either. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Do we have to pile dirt up around them? You know, like with celery, you have to protect it from the sun so it doesn't turn, get so hard and green. So I don't know if that's what I did wrong with my leeks or not. But leeks are readily available in stores now. And they aren't very expensive, and they are very good. You just need to kind of like peel the little parts apart and make sure there's no extra sand in them, grit or dirt. You always have to wash them after
you cut them. You can't wash it and then cut it and think you've done a good job.
Right, because apparently they grow layer by layer or something.
Another vegetable that you find in the store now all the time is sort of a 21st century piece to me because I didn't grow up with it, but now you see kale in everything. You can fry it and dry it and do all kinds of stuff with it.
And I grow kale because it's an easy thing to grow, but I have a hard time finding people who want to eat it. Now, this is what happened this year. My kale was eaten up by flea beetles. I mean, devastated, down to the ground. But it came back again, I hated to throw it away because after it frosted and got a little chilly here a couple nights, oh my gosh, that was amazing. That changes the flavor of kale so that everybody should like kale. And kale is a powerhouse vegetable. And sometimes when your soil is healthy and your plants are sturdy like kale is like, I'm coming back. Nothing's going to keep me from growing. That's good for you, too. You absorb some of that hardiness from those vegetables. And kale, like if you just even want to introduce it to your family, chop up some kale, stir fry it with a little onions and some butter, throw some eggs that you beat up with a little milk over the top of that, Parmesan cheese, and bake that in your oven until it sets up. That is so good. It's like a kale frittata. And the kale is delicious. You can't really, it's not bitter anymore. And so, yes, I would definitely try kale. And you're right, Doug. None of us had kale growing up.
Now, we also see so many varieties of onions now. I mean, it was yellow or white. I remember when I was growing up, then we got red, then we got sweet. Now, what's the difference with a fall onion and the ones that we get the rest of the time of the year? Are those ones that's just been in storage or what?
Well, there's actually different types of onion varieties that you grow. Like sweet onions do not store well. They have a higher water content. They're a softer onion. Then you have what is called a storage onion. And those are the ones that are like, they've got a real tight, firm skin on them. And I have had Dakota Tier onions from the Podal farm down in Fullerton. They sell us an onion seed that you can grow out. And I'll tell you what, those onions will last you until you have spring onions, which are a totally different variety of onion. Once again, you have winter onions, Egyptian onions, or walking onions that will come up as soon as they feel like in the spring. And you can cut those and eat them like little green onions, or you can let them grow a little bit thicker. And then they have more white and less green on them. So you can start eating onions early in the year. And then as your other onions develop, you can always pick them and eat them. But if you want them to store, you leave them in the ground until their tops dry off. And then you pick them and braid them or put them in a breathable bag. And they last for a good long time. They are also a little more pungent than your sweet onions and your green onions. And I grew some yellow, or were they the white ones? I grew some onions this year that even in their tiny little size were just like tearjerkers, man. They were so strong.
I just heard this the other day that you can put a match in between your teeth when cutting onions. Does that work?
I have never tried that, but
I've never heard that one
for a really long time. And so I like to cry. My eyes are dry naturally, so I don't mind that. But these little white onions were like stingers, man. Now, here's something I bet you didn't know. My kids or my husband, I can't remember who, bought me a bar of soap that was made out of stainless steel. So it looks like a bar of soap, but it's a stainless steel bar that when you have that smell on your hands from onions or garlic, you just use that stainless steel bar and that takes that smell away just like that. It is crazy. It works. Trust me. And you know what? If you caramelize any kind of onion, you will take some of that sting away also. It becomes really sweet, much sweeter as it caramelizes. And it's a slow process, but think French onion soup, which is really quite easy to make if you have the patience to caramelize your onions. And I would highly recommend giving that a try because onions are full of nutrition. They're so good for you. And they also are very inexpensive vegetables that you can hide in a lot of foods if you know how. You're a clever mother. You know, like if your kids don't like onions, grate them. Grate them and make them really fine. And then you can put them in anything.
We check in with Sue Belcom every week. Thank you, Sue.
Thanks, guys. It was my pleasure.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Welcome to Seneca, Nebraska.
Oh, Lord, this is a small town. Nobody gets along.
It just got so ugly.
Aggressive comments.
Do you flaunt your chickens? Do they run around town?
What about a Xanax?
You're not going to tell me.
It had to do with what was happening in Seneca, but I also believe that it had to do with what was happening in the United States.
A town unincorporated. That's on the next Radiolab.
I believe in democracy. Does that make me an idiot?
Saturday at noon, 11 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 5th. With easy access to up-to-date reports, few people today rely on a weather vane for their weather predictions. Today, a weather vane is mostly for decoration. But at one time, they were an important tool for anyone who needed to know what the weather had in store. On this date in 1903, the Hope Pioneer newspaper reminded readers of the humble weather vane that was so often taken for granted. weather vanes were usually placed at the highest point on a house or barn. It had to be away from trees that could influence the wind. On the Great Plains, that wasn't difficult. There is a weight at the point of the weather vane arrow. The rear of the weather vane is lighter and catches the breeze. The airflow is distributed evenly on both sides of the weather vane, which turns the point of the arrow into the wind. From ancient times, people paid attention to the wind to predict the weather. They knew that a change in the wind meant a change in the weather, and they were common in colonial America. Thomas Jefferson's weather vane was connected to a compass on the ceiling of Monticello. Jefferson could see the direction of the wind while he sat in his library. George Washington was another keen observer of the weather. His weather vane is still on the cupola of Mount Vernon. In 1903, in North Dakota, the farmer had to be his own weatherman and pay close attention to the wind. Virtually every barn had a weather vane. The experienced farmer knew that as long as the wind was in the usual speed and direction, the weather would be stable. A glance at the weather vane could alert the farmer to expect rain, snow, or even a storm. It could also predict a temperature change. South winds would bring warm temperatures, while a north wind brings cold. Today we view weather vanes as interesting decorative elements, but the next time you see one, you might give a thought to how important they were to early North Dakotans. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Jonathan and Money Pon Haug, in celebration of their son Simon's birthday. Happy birthday, Simon.
Michigan's Secretary of State says her state's election results are solid.
I think it's time that we all come together and not allow frivolous lawsuits or any effort to misinform the public about the truth behind our elections.
That has not prevented President Trump's campaign from filing suit in multiple states. We will stick to the facts of the presidential election on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream online at prairiepublic.org. After the broadcast, you can find any of our Main Street shows at prairiepublic.org. Friday on our show, philosophy professor Jack Russell Weinstein will talk about this Sunday's Why philosophical discussions about everyday life when he discusses propaganda with Jason Stanley in an episode titled How Does Propaganda Work? News director Dave Thompson will join us to talk about the week's big stories, and Matt Olien will review Let Him Go, starring Kevin Costner and Diane Lane in a 60s-era North Dakota. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.